Hennessy gets to the door, and he says, "What's this?" And somebody says, "Well, Mr. Hennessy, this is some samples from the Fisher collection. This is the Fisher Museum." And he never stepped in the door. He said brutally to some friend, "How much is this stuff insured for?" And the accolade said, "I don't know, Mr. Hennessy, but I'll find out," making a note quickly from his notebook. "I don't know, but I'll find out." And Hennessy turned around and walked away. So that was how much interest they had in it.
Oh,
and
my goodness.
They didn't know what they bought, nor did they care, nor did he care. And he's a strange man. And so John Pavlik, who was then the curator, is standing in the doorway as they walk away down the hall. Never seen anything like it. Never heard of anybody. Did at least three steps, you know, and put your head around it. Not 1993 steps.
Yeah.
So that was it. That was the end of it. And it got sold, as you know, the history of the company went through ups and downs and ups and downs and ended up in completely different hands, which is where it now is. And they have a very fine respect for it.
Yes, they do.
And so they use it. Now, I think as a kid, somewhere along the line, maybe it was not when I was summer jobbing. My first summer job there, and this is all in the document I have here and in the talk, I wrapped packages in the receiving department. So stuff came in bulk. Might be 200 packages of filler paper, 100 pieces to a pack. But
right.
So packages. And they'd be this big crate. Well, you don't sell them that way. You sell them in dozens.
Right.
So you'd take 12 and wrap them and put a label on it.
Repackaging.
And you put a label on it, which was Dad's idea, because then you didn't get them so mixed up in the stock department. Mm-hmm. And you picked orders by catalog number, like Sears Roebuck does, mm-hmm. or as Sears Roebuck does. So the time to get the right catalog on is that when you first receive it, because then it isn't going to get fixed up later on. So when it first comes in, get your catalog number on, because you live by catalog. And I spent several summers wrapping glassware and thermometers, and it came in bulk.
So was there art in the stock room as well?
No, it was too,
messy.
You might move a box into it and crush it.
So was it in the offices?
Offices. And some labs. We had a research lab, and it had some works in it.
Did it?
And the offices of the research people had reproductions or some originals. That was a bit of a, when we formed the museum, that was a bit of a heartbreak, because you'd go into some guy who had a picture on his wall for 10 or 15 years, you'd grow quite accustomed to it, and you'd say, "George, I'm sorry to tell you, but we're creating a museum, and we're going to put some of these pictures in the museum.
They're
kind of the highlights of the collection, and I'm afraid to tell you, we're going to take that away, and we can replace it if you like. We'll give you a choice. We'll work it out with you, because we got some other nice things that we're not going to put in the museum. We can put that back in your office."
Right.
So what was he going to say? He said grudgingly, "Well, okay."
But he wasn't happy.
No, he wasn't happy, but he got another picture on his wall. I gave him a little class. You know.
Right. Now you do form attachments to certain paintings that you live with. You absolutely do.
So it was the publication that had it on the cover, and the beginning to offer the reproductions in the catalog, the general catalog, that began to create the interest and the recognition of the collection.
Yeah.
And if you keep that up for 20 or 30 years, you get it closely associated with the company.
Oh, absolutely. The Fisher Collection is very closely associated in many people's minds. I tour so many people through the collection, and they have reproductions at home. They love them.
They've heard about it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Many, many, over and over again.
Yeah. Well, that's what I really know. Of course, they couldn't all be in Father's office. It was a modest office, and he had four pictures, I think, or something in his office.
About really?
Something like that, that's right.
Really?
None at home.
Did he have particular friends or colleagues that he shared this interest with that you can recollect?
Well, he had one close personal friend who was also a business client, customer. And that was a man named Weidlein, W-E-I-D-L-E-I-N, Dr. Weidlein. He was a man from Kansas who took his PhD very seriously. And he was spent his entire life known as Dr. Weidlein. He wanted you to know that. He had three boys, and we grew up with the boys. They were close friends. Two of them are still living today, and are good friends of mine. One of them is exactly my age. Hmm. And he and his wife and my mother and father were close bridge-playing friends. People played bridge in those days. Dr. Weidlein was about 7 or 8 years younger than Dad, but he very nice, pleasant man, always polite, and although self-important. And Dr. Weidlein was well aware of the collection because he and Dad were personal friends, and they would talk about the alchemist and the history of science. And Dr. Weidlein was a PhD in chemistry.
Oh.
And director of the Mellon Institute of Industrial Research.
Oh.
So obviously steeped in laboratory science and history science.
Wonderful.
And so they shared that for years. But my dad's other friends were industrial people, but they were not laboratory people. They were industry people, executives.
Right.
In manufacturing, for the most part. And Dad had a rather large collection because he played golf. He took up golf when he was about 38 or 40. And I guess tennis became a little too tough on the knees, as it does for everybody. And went to the golf pro to take some early lessons. He was a natural athlete, and he played pretty good golf. I imagine he played pretty good tennis, too, before that. And he said to the pro, "Gee, I wish I'd started this golf earlier." And the pro said, "Mr. Fisher, it's already too late." But Dad perfected his own style, and he enjoyed it. And, oh, he loved to play golf. Hot weather or not, he loved to play golf.
Did you ever hear him discussing the apparatus in that was depicted in the artworks?
Yes. When he acquired a new part of the collection, whatever it was, a drawing, a photograph, historical document, as I became more and more interested in it, I became the kind of designated driver. I became the one. Aiken and Ben, we were all very busy, but Aiken and Ben never took a great interest in it. Enough so they weren't diffident, and when we had these gatherings in the museum, they would pick up in the conversation. They didn't just stand there like stone, you know, so that the visitor got the impression that we were all knowledgeable about it.
Right.
But whenever there was a question, they would defer to me. What would that be, Jim? And I'd say, well, that would be about 1800, something like that.
Because you and your dad were the ones
that
discussed.
That's right. So he would call me down to the office, and he'd say, I'm thinking of buying this from a photograph, or I have just bought this. And he'd have someone come in and help him unwrap it or unpack it.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would point out to me in that picture, let's say it was an alchemist, a big print of an alchemist. He would point out to me what was going on in that picture and how that, you remember, he'd say that, you remember that looks by, so just like the one we had by Van Heemskerk. And I'd say,
right.
Yes, and that one has a so-and-so in it. And say, that's right.
Right.
So we'd have this discussion about that work.
Yes, yeah.
And then if it was going to be hung, say, in the museum later on, or if it was going to be hung on the wall somewhere, it ought to be framed because it's the only way to really kind of keep them. And he'd say, do you think it ought to be framed? I'd say, yes, I think I do. And he'd say, well, take care of that. So I would take care of it, remove it, bring it up to my office, and then I would, of course, take it to a framer, and we'd talk about the right mat or no mat and the right mat.
Right.
And it would come back, and Dad would approve it, and then it would be dispatched and it would go in somebody's office, or maybe it would later would go into the museum. Depends. You'd have to take something down because the museum was full.
Right.
There are pictures, by the way, Marge, of the museum in action. There's people standing around. There's a little picture of it in this recap.
Is there?
And it wasn't a big room, but it was. It had indirect lighting and a carpet.
There's a photograph in one of the brochures mm-hmm. of the museum, mm-hmm. as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
What it looked like. It was very elegant.
They had that louvers. And sort of beams and lights between them. So when you looked up, you didn't see light. You just saw the effect of light.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty hot stuff for its time.
Thank you.
For its period, it was.
Yeah. So you built the museum. Where did you get the ideas about designing the gallery? Because it's really...
An architect who redesigned the offices and the kitchen and the Pasteur room, and a close friend of mine named Curry, C-U-R-R-Y, had that as his assignment in doing over the 1946 building. I'm not sure. I don't think the museum was absolutely original in the 1946 edition. I'm pretty sure it wasn't. But shortly after that, it was necessary to make some substantial changes inside the building. And that's when we did this. I remember. We needed more space. So we built a balcony over part of an open area that gave us some more rooms off the balcony. And at the end of the balcony, suspended in a kind of a super balcony, was the new kitchen, cafeteria, Pasteur Memorial, and museum. So we got out of air. We created new floor space. And that's when Mr. Curry, his personal friend, now dead, who was my age, he was much younger, and so was I. And he was that kind of thinking. He did contemporary style.
Yeah, it looks
that
very
was,
nice.
That was his
He's
style.
Better pictures than I've
he seen. Didn't do classic architecture at all
mm-hmm.
in any job he ever did. He just wasn't that style.
Mm-hmm.
So he gave us something that was quite with it for the time.
I'm not surprised by it. It's very sharp.
Yeah, it would pass today for a very crisp looking.
Yes, exactly.
Place. He also did some very clever things. He called upon him to help relay out the main office, which was on the same floor when he was in the older building. And he painted all in the columns bright orange. You know, you normally paint offices cream, white, or
sure.
I rest green. This is invented by the Pittsburgh Plate Glass Company, PPG. And they sold train loads of I rest green. Very, very light green, but it was not like these walls of cream, which was gets dulled. So you had this nice soft green in the busy office that was supposed to be restful.
Mm-hmm.
Nice and restful. So we had miles of I rest green. And Grant said, this is no way to run an office. That was Curry. So he came in and he designed it, and he'd have a column, and he'd have strong blue on 1/4 of a square column. And on the opposite side of the square column, he'd have bright orange. And in between, it would be cream or something. Well, you'd be surprised the effect it had on people working in the office. There was a new pep. There was a new zip to the office.
Great.
Those were the days. So that's how we got into that. Most of his friends were only aware dimly of the collection. Dad
it was there
had
for his pleasure. It was his pleasure, and he didn't. That was.
But at the very same time, he saw the public relations dimension.
Yes.
It was truly a tandem concept for Dad. It was his heart love. It was the only business he ever owned and ran in his whole life. It was his whole life, outside of his family, of course. And so he combined this collection to honor Sinus of all ilk. And at the same time, it was a magnificent public relations device for the company. Without being crude or too forward or too commercial, it was the world's most subtle sort of thing. You know, the big pharmaceutical companies picked that idea up. Now, I don't know that they picked it up from Fisher, but somehow in the 50s, the big pharmaceutical companies began to either reproduce works of art of physicians and surgeons, which they offered in high-class reproductions to physicians, or they had them made by very skillful, what amounts to poster artists.
Commission.
Can be very good. Commission.
Mm-hmm.
A poster artist is just short of a fine art. Mm-hmm. And many have made the transition.
Mm-hmm.
And there was the physician sitting by the bedside and the sick child, the anxious parents over
right.
at the side, and a candle perhaps, because we're looking at 1870.
A 1880. Comfort image.
Yeah, and then below, produced through the generosity of Upjohn Corporation, mm-hmm. or Eli Lilly, or Park Davis, mm-hmm. or all of these old-time pharmaceutical companies.
Mm-hmm.
And what they were doing is honoring the physician, who's their customer, because these are all prescription drugs, you know, for the most part. And doing public relations, you see, at the same time. So it's not unique in the world. Ed was early, very early.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's unique to the Fisher industry, our kind of industry either. And I just gave an example. But
very good.
That's why he did it. And it was very, very successful. Now, we'll have to talk to others about some of these questions.
Yeah, like other museums that borrowed the collection. I mean, we know that the Carnegie did, and that the
yes.
Franklin Institute did.
I'm not sure that those were... they may be the only two venues.
Really?
Now, there were some Fisher Scientific venues, but that was in company. When we opened a couple of branches in order to try and make an event to get people to come, because it really was a warehouse and an office. With about one exception, they were not manufacturing plants. They weren't, you know, you build a big box. I mean, literally, you build mm-hmm. a big box. You fill it with cases of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And you have an office of 10 or 15 people. And that's all you need. And bingo,
mm-hmm.
you're in business in
mm-hmm.
St. Louis and
mm-hmm.
Houston and Atlanta and Silver Spring, Maryland and Medford near Boston. And I could go on and on and on. We opened 30 of them or something. And not always, but when you wanted an event, you might take selections and have them temporary wrapped by furniture movers for these big blankets. And then the whole van, the whole truck would go to the site, and then
right.
you'd have people there and they'd unload it.
Right.
And then you'd have temporary walls set up from rental agencies, as you know you can for weddings and receptions and whatever. And then you'd hang these things. And so you had either half of the office or maybe none of the office and a piece of the warehouse. Which were, you know, nice, clean, brightly lit, brand new, concrete floor, all that
right,
sort of stuff.
Right.
With the collection. And then you'd have punch, usually, you're trying to get around the alcohol problem. You need to have cocktails, but you'd have non-alcohol punch and non-alc punch for those who wanted it. Sort of small sandwiches and a nice invitation.
A little reception for the opening of the
and
building.
And you'd get 200-300 people, and you'd get publicity, and it was a way of saying to the people in that area, we're here now. It was much more important in those days, because you didn't have online stuff, you see. Today it doesn't make any difference. You pick up the phone, you dial a number, and you don't care if the stuff
where
is in Kansas City.
Yeah,
it's going to be...
Right, right. Very different.
Oh, totally different business. Physical presence of being in these towns was catastrophe for competition. They were already there. But in comes this big guy with this huge national inventory and a way to connect his inventory and a monster advertising PR, publicity, direct mail, catalog program. It was tough. I mean, it really...
So you're saying that the impact of your arrival was not well received by, or it was what well received
by the competitor?
Yeah, well, by
they
the
must
competitor.
Have, that's no. what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I'm talking only about competitors.
But the
only.
But the city, the town itself is probably delighted to have you.
More jobs.
Yes.
Every town loves jobs.
Yes.
Every city says, "Oh, the Baba's going to open here." I don't care who it is.
Right.
I mean, except the brothel maybe, but I mean, everybody said, "Joe, we're glad to have the ABC company come here." And it's another 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 jobs.
Right.
Well, they always said, no, the competitor was a guy who ground his teeth. And that, plus the two-year catalog, just finished him. It was brutal. It really was brutal. I don't think in any way it was illegal. But it was just...
So did you usually end up buying the company?
Many. 20 or 30.
Mm-hmm.
And you carried the name for a little bit. And, you know, for 6 months on the phone when they'd asked for so-and-so, they were all trained how to answer it. I'd get lost very few. You don't know how much you lost because you can't measure it.
But right, right.
You lost very little.
Right.
And all the branches took a lump. But that was one of the... That was one... way to use a different venue for the collection. And then, as you say, the Franklin Institute and at Carnegie Museum of Art here in town. They had some free time and the director prevailed on us to lend, I don't know, maybe 30 works of art or something like that.
We're looking to find, there was a book. A catalog of that. You don't happen to have it at the point, do you?
You can see the state of my office.
Because if you do, we're going to try to get one from them in case they should happen to have an extra one, but it seems unlikely.
Well,
so we would like to find one.
The director of the Museum of Art is a close personal friend and have helped him in many ways, and he knew Richard Armstrong. I don't know where he is today. But his office, I could call ahead and tell them you're coming, and they'll do anything they can for you. And they're the nicest sort of people, and Richard Armstrong will he wants to give instructions to Miss Gap is coming, give her anything she wants. That's all it takes.
I think they're more pinched. They physically don't have another body.
Did they tell you that?
They said it was a long time.
Oh yeah, he
said before.
The chances are they don't.
She did look. She looked, and then they called me back and said,
"I didn't know you got called back."
Well, okay, there aren't any. It wouldn't surprise me. You know,
we're gonna scare
a major museum has 3 or 4 changing exhibits a year, and so since then it would be 100 in 25 years.
And they don't usually have space to keep more than one copy of those things.
No,
I work at the Philadelphia Museum as well.
Which museum?
The Philadelphia Museum.
Oh, I see.
And we have all these
catalogs. Yeah, same problem.
We have tons of old catalogs in the back of the office, but that doesn't mean every institution does this.
Well, when you print a catalog for a big show, you always guess. I'm on the committee, the budget committee, on the museum, and all of those sort of things, and on the board. And you know, you say you're going to print 2,000 or 6,000. And these are expensive catalogs. And you have no idea how it's going to sell. I mean, you either run out or you have them left over. You just can't be right.
Yeah.
And then when you get all through and it's all done and it's a year later and all, what you do, and you run out of storage space, you say, well, let's keep a dozen. Because we just can't.
Right.
And you push all the rest out into the market, and there's a faint, faint, faint aftermarket out there, and they go for a buck or two someplace.
Right.
In little shops all over the country. And they vanish. They evaporate. So, I don't know.
Well, did your dad have an art collection, an art book collection? Did he collect art books?
He never was interested in art.
No.
Never. Neither was mother. They were totally untutored. Totally untutored in the field of art. They did the right thing, and the Americans did. You went abroad, you went to the art museums, far more than you went to art museums in the United States. I don't think mother ever was in an art museum in the United States in her life. And she went to X, Y, and Z in Europe because it was the thing to do. It's what Americans did. You couldn't go to Paris without going through the Louvre. And you can't help but be impressed with what you're looking at, but you don't really know what you're looking at. There was no real appreciation of art, the history of art, fine art, knowledge of art at home. We had a fine painting in the dining room of a 18th century army officer, a cavalry officer, and a fine white horse, beautiful painting, big, beautiful painting over the fireplace in the dining room. But I don't think anybody had a clue as to who painted or who the subject was. But it was a beautiful thing. And that's, it was a scene of Venice in the living room, which was a certain style of a mirror below, probably was bigger in its day, where you had a giant mirror and a panel above, which is a very, when ceilings were tall in the old days. And that was a very common form of decorative arts. Mm-hmm. And you get a good artist to paint a scene. Mm-hmm. And Venice, of course, is the perennial favorite, because it's the sentimental favorite,
right.
Classical favorite. And we had the upper half of a very lovely panel, a mirror below with an antique mirror in it. And the kids would look at the antique mirror and see if it's kind of speckled and imperfect and... because glass making was imperfect and mirror making was imperfect. And above it was this beautiful scene of Venice. And we knew it as Venice because Mother and Dad said, that's Venice. That's what it was. But that was about all. So there really wasn't... there wasn't much. There was an itinerant artist who painted my great-great-grandmother, and I have it at home, a Scots-Irish woman with the false teeth and a stern face and a bonnet. It was painted about 1810 by an itinerant artist. It's a good painting, really, but we don't know who it is, but it's been handed down.
Right.
That's the sort of stuff in the house. It wasn't fine art. Dad never collected fine art. I mean, he could have bought, God, you know, the history. He was a man of some means in the 40s and 50s. 30s, of course, were tough going. The Great Depression lasted all through the 30s. And but even in the 20s, he was, relative to his time, he was a well-to-do man. And we lived quite well. And you could have bought Picasso for $200, $300.
Sure.
Painters of that period, Miro and the turn of the 20s, but for nothing. They just hadn't been discovered. Stuff that goes for 1, 2, 3, 5 million today. Hindsight's great.
Well, he bought, what he bought was great for us.
He bought this stuff, and all out of his own money, as I said.
There seems to be a very tight span when you really purchased most of his paintings. But do you remember it being more spread out?
Well, he continued to collect until he died in 65. I would say he collected up to about 1960. He began to have some health problems. My recollection of I bought from a few things from about 55 through, or maybe through 1960 through about 1975, because when an offering came, it more likely came to me, or it came to Dad and he would send it to me. And you'd look at the offering and you'd think, well, sometimes it's almost a dupe of something we already have, and thank the man. Or it was something new. Or it was a print that was a little bit different than the one we had. We'd go and look at the one, and yeah, I think it was $100. And let's get it.
Right.
So we have hundreds of those.
Right.
And if you couldn't get any of that, sometimes you'd say, well, we'll tell you what we'll do, we'll pay you for a photograph. And then some of these people, having already been turned down on the sale, would foolishly say, all right, you know, $25 or $50 and we'll send you a photograph. So we had a lot of photographs. But it was a relatively short period. And don't forget, a big chunk of the collection was the Pope collection. You know about that. Boy. You see, that gave it one chunk.
Is there a list of what was included in the Pope collection? That probably material that went to the company and you're saying is lost, but do you yourself think that there would be?
I think John at the local company.
Because that would be invaluable.
When you came in from the airport, you went by.
Did we?
A business complex, a suburban business complex. Roughly halfway between the airport and the city. A big office buildings. You know, the standard procedure, get out of the city. And they're there.
That's where John
is. And that's where John is. And he could answer whether he has a list of what was in the Pope collection in his files.
That would be very helpful.
I could have thought he might have turned it over to you guys, to Philadelphia.
The only thing we got was a Xerox copy of Chester Fisher's notes, you know, with his notebook. And that does have a lot of information, but it doesn't, it's not original, and some of it's hard to read, and it's not really documents.
Well,
it's
we
like
can
his
ask
notes.
John. It's easy to ring John and see if he's there, and I'd call him another time. He's 5 miles from here. And Harry would know, but Harry wouldn't have any records. He might have a memory. I'm almost certain there was a list.
I'm
sure there was. And you know the story on that. He had a man bid on an auction, and he sent it over a ship, torpedo, and came back and tried it again. And this time it made it. And now that was not in number, but in quality. That was a very huge impetus to the collection. It equaled the fine stuff that Dad already had, so in the fine stuff essentially kind of doubled. But it did not have all this collateral information only stuff, with copies of prints and photographs.
It wasn't prints as well.
Mm-hmm.
It was only paintings.
It was engravings fine paintings. And
right.
They were really fine works in the Pope. That was done. He collected on a dual scale. He collected obviously the history of science, but he also had a threshold of, he was not interested in a $5 copy of something for the heck of it, because it was of interest and he could use it for advertising. That wasn't his. He was an eminent scientist.
Right.
Chemist.
Cambridge.
And I collect for interest. That stuff, some of that stuff is photographs of maps because I couldn't get them. But it has a theme. The theme is the history of Western Pennsylvania and Pittsburgh. So I have lots of that, but they're not worth $5.
It's the cost.
I'm collecting for a different reason.
Right.
So you're right. There was quite a spurt at that one point. And then
this is during the war, though.
Well, you didn't get much offering during the war because most people, most dealers would have surmised that there was no way to ship it.
Yeah.
You know, shipping the war from 39 to 45, the North Atlantic was just a minefield. It was called an ocean, but it really was a minefield. And how that shipment ever got through, I have no idea. The only thing I can think of is that the U-boats a limited number of torpedoes. But why torpedo a ship coming going west? It wasn't carrying any supplies to England. The United States, of course, kept England alive in the mid, you know, without it. And it would have been all over. Because we would have had no staging ground for the invasion. Maybe, you know, in the long, long, long run, the United States and its allies would have won that war, but it was a completely different scenario. So my guess is that you got a ship going west, and the undersea boat captain would say, why waste a torpedo on that? We're trying to get them going the other way.
Like we have German POWs.
Yes, it conceivably could. But it didn't have munitions and food and all the stuff that kept England alive. So. And of course, it was going west with the freight. So there you go. I don't know why it was torpedoed the first time.
It's bizarre.
And we don't even know for sure that it was torpedoed. We know the ship was damaged. It could have been a shot.
Or a mine.
It could have been a mine. It could have been a submarine that surfaced and figured, well, we'll give it one shell. Yeah. And if it turns and runs, we're not going to chase it if fuel is limited.
Right.
They had about a 75 millimeter gun on deck. Yeah. Did you give it one wham and injure it? And
could have had fuel, of course.
Yeah, and it, but it didn't go up. It went, got back to port somewhere.
Good for us.
It's a funny story. Harry Schwab told that story for years before audiences all over the United States. And he ended that part of it by saying, and you can imagine the joy in Pittsburgh when the shipment arrived, which is even more surprising since we're 300 miles from the coast. And the audience were all laughing. Because that's the kind of way he told stories. You know. And Harry is a great storyteller.
Yeah, I haven't met him, but I've heard about his storytelling.
What he doesn't know, he makes up.
I guess, what do you know about the Harmony Society, Old Economy Village? Do you know anything about your father's relationship with them?
I wasn't aware of any.
I see.
We know what it is. It's a early 19th century, late 18th century, around early 19th century village set up around a religious concept centering, like the Mormons, around a certain religious leader.
Right.
Who moved west for inexpensive land and the right to build and live as he and his followers wanted in every style. And the theme was self-sufficiency.
Right.
You grew everything you ate, you made everything by hand as you needed, you made your tools by with what, I don't know, but you made your tools with tools you had made, and where it starts.
And evidently they were preparing for a second coming, which they thought was
second coming, as to a certain degree of the Mormons. Right. It's wrapped up with a religious concept. And it's in Economy, Pennsylvania, which is down the Ohio River. It's about a 45-minute drive from Pittsburgh on the Ohio, and it's now open to the public, Williamsburg-style village museum.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, not so much reconstructed as Williamsburg is, to a great degree. It's almost totally original. Of course, it's much younger than Williamsburg.
Yeah.
And to historians of various types, it's extremely interesting. It doesn't happen to be a particular great interest to me. I'm interested in the history of the area, but it could have been in Ohio. It is not a history of this city. It's only a dim part of the connection of the history of this city, which was a fort, and that the triangulation of the river was, you know, Lewis and Clark started their trip here and went all the way to the Pacific. You know, this city has a whole lot of importance of itself, not just a steel center, but as a transportation. And George Washington came here three times, was shot at, damn near killed.
Well,
one, once left with three holes in his jacket from bullets. I mean, yeah, it wouldn't have made George Washington. It's loaded with American history, this triangle.
Right. Well, evidently, the director, Raymond Shepard, has records that your father gave some laboratory, old alchemical laboratory equipment, to this museum.
Well, I didn't know that, and I would be very, very doubtful if it's alchemical equipment.
Maybe it's
I never had any idea, a concept that we ever had any alchemical material. We do have a little bit in the collection of Pasteur material, but you understand that's a whole lot later.
That's a different.
A whole lot later.
That's totally different.
The alchemical period, the height was about 1640, 50, 60 in that period, or even earlier. It really wouldn't have any collection with the economy, the village, because that was much later. And so you're telling me something about which I know nothing.
I
never heard of it. And I'd been there, and I wouldn't necessarily mean that it wasn't there and I didn't see it, but I never even heard about it. I never thought to ask. And I doubt if it was alchemical material. Now, it's conceivable that he might have come across some apparatus of about the period when that was founded from some collector. And had no real need for it, there being no Fisher Museum at that time. So he might have said, what am I going to do with this? See, I'm just conjecturing.
Some earlier chemical equipment, yeah.
Just about the time of the old economy, which was in 1800 or something like that, wasn't it? Isn't that about that?
Right.
So he might have said, well, this is 1800 stuff, and I don't know what to do with it.
Could be.
And he very well might have given it to them. I'm just conjecturing.
Right.
But that's news to me that we have any connection with that place, other than an interest in museums.
Right.
I belong to a local association I don't. I'm on two museum boards, and they are members of a 60 museum group, the Greater Pittsburgh Museum Council, which is four counties, museums of all kinds, every kind, historical, art, science, planetariums, zoos, aquaria, there's an old trolley museum, there's blah, 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 everything. And we belong to a loose federation.
Consortium.
And through that, and old economy
is part of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Well, they evidently had some paintings that they no longer own, and so I guess he was also speculating as to whether or not paintings, and evidently there was a Teniers, there were two small pictures by David Teniers, so he wondered whether or not they had been sold to Fisher. I mean, this is all speculation also, and...
Well, I can't help you. And has someone talked to the director there?
I have spoken to the director there, and he knows no more about it than what I just told you.
We run into a blank wall then, because I can't shed any light on that subject. The David Teniers that we have in the collection, which is now becoming the Heritage Foundation, is everyone that I ever had any contact with. Now, your friend that Aldrich, he might have had that, because it was kind of a favorite topic of Teniers, the younger, because he was a genre painter, and as Bruegel and others, and you know the village scenes, the rustic scenes, the country wedding, the farmer's picnic. Those sort of things, and that's why he painted The Alchemist, because he was a very interesting old geezer in the village. He was part of the scene of the old village, as Van Gogh painted the postman. That's the standard, not royalty, but the postman. You see what I mean? It was a different way of.
And he's a close follower of Brouwer, who is a close imitator, very close, with Membroke and Chain. group for up to 15 years.
Right.
But he is very, I mean, his scenes are much more, I think, somber and dignified.
Oh, yes, because Broder was raucous. Yeah. Not like nothing better than the company picnic or what, and yeah. Girls are being chased and their trousers are being pulled off and everything in the world's going on in those pictures.
Yeah.
You know, they're really very raunchy.
Yes,
as was the period.
Yeah. That's important to remember.
Yeah. He was a genre painter, and he was photographing, in a way, what was going on.
Recording, yes.
Yeah. And that was what was going on. It was a lusty period. It just lacked the reserve. It came in much later under